Welcome to the Determined Truth Podcast.
What the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Where we aim to explore questions of truth, the scriptures, and what it means for the church today. Here are your hosts, Rob Dalrymple and Vinny Angelo.
Hey everyone, welcome in. We are continuing through Revelation, and last week we gave an overview of chapter 17. We started talking about the great prostitute as just a big picture, but we're going to parse it out a little bit today, right? You want to get into the nitty gritty, as they call it?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's begin with a brief review. Okay. A couple of things that maybe focus on that is the great prostitute contrasts with the woman, the bride, the wife of the Lamb. It's going to be really important to recognize the structure of what's happening. Chapter 17, 1 through 19, 10 begins with John being taken into the wilderness and he sees a woman sitting on a beast. It ends in 19, 10 with John worshiping the angel. That is going to be paralleled with 21, 9 through 22, 9. 21, 9, John's taken up to a mountain and he sees the bride. So in both cases, he's taken somewhere, he's in the spirit, and he sees a woman. One's the harlot, one's the bride. 22, 8 and 9, John falls down at the feet of the angel to worship it again. He says, hey, don't do that. In both cases, he worships an angel. So we have these contrasting. One is the kingdom of God and the people of God. One is the nations of the world. And maybe the easiest way to say it is the harlot Babylon represents the economic side of the empire, the material side of the empire, pleasure, things, comfort, security.
Materialism.
Exactly. Very good. Of which those in power are benefiting the most. And especially in the Roman Empire, those who are the poor, the 90% that we've discussed, are struggling each day to have enough food to survive while the wealthy are living this lavish lives. And we'll see especially the lavishness in next week's study.
Okay. As we usually do, let's skim through the text real quick. So chapter 17, verses 1 through 7. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. So we did an overview of that last week, but we're going to dig into this a little bit more this week.
Yes. So let's just begin really briefly. It says she sits on many waters. In chapter 17, verse 15, it says the waters where the woman sits are many peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So she's sitting on these waters and the nations of the earth have become drunk in her immorality. They've become drunk with her prosperity, the pleasure, the commercialism, the security, the comforts. Those things have caused them to be drunk with her wine.
And it's interesting because in the text, she's described as well-adorned. She's beautiful. There's gold, there's precious stones and pearls. We talked about that last week. But John doesn't want us to get distracted with that. He wants us to know that she's nothing more than a great prostitute. She's a harlot.
Exactly. And that's one of the keys. Again, going back to what I think we might have said this last week also, that the nature of an apocalypse is that it reveals the way things actually are. So you see pleasure, comfort, power, security, and this great wealth. Oh, what a glorious thing the Pax Romana has brought, as we mentioned. But John's like, I see the blood of innocent people. I see that this woman's a harlot who's drunk on the blood and the backs of slaves and others who have done all these things and been abused so that Rome can indulge. And I think there's a lot to be said. Let me insert right now, Vinny. You and I talked before we even got started that the great prostitute, I think, might be more important to understand what this is and what this means for us today than the beast. We get caught up on the beast and the mark of the beast and 666, and is this some end times empire? And we get caught up in all that. But really, for us, especially in the Western world, who've become wealthy and prosperous, the great prostitute is actually more significant for us. And it's the great prostitute that seduces God's people. In fact, John's being seduced by her himself.
Yeah. When I was reading that, one thing that struck me, just paralleling, and I think we're going to talk about this later today, but it's comparing the unholy Trinity versus the Trinity, the book. One of the first ways that Jesus is described in chapter one is in his right hand, he's holding the churches, basically, as that's unveiled. The seven stars. Yeah. Here, though, she's holding in her hand, it doesn't say right hand, just in her hand, a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immoralities. I don't know, that just popped out of me. Yeah. But these are things that are full of blood.
And in chapter 17, where you ended up, it says she's drunk with the blood of the saints, verse 6, the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Then in chapter 18, at the end of this section describing her, it says in her was found the blood of prophets. This is 18, verse 24. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth.
Is it all who have been slain in toto, like anyone, or is it just the people of God who she's slain?
Personally, I think it's only the people of God. I understand why you might read this and go, okay, there's all who've been slain on the earth. But I think John's restricting his vision to only the people of God. I don't think it really matters ultimately because she's guilty of both.
Yeah.
But I think if you look at the word slay and how it's used in the book of Revelation, it seems to be used in reference to the people of God only. Of course, the beast had one of its heads was slain in chapter 13, but that was only, I think, because the beast is trying to imitate Christ. So remember, as if he was slain, it's the same description of Jesus and the lamb as if he was slain in chapter 5. So I think that this word slay is a reference to the people of God, and I would limit it to that. But I think the point of that is her blood and what she's done is the injustice that which God is going to bring about justice for her.
Okay. The last verse, and I remember last week when I read this, I followed the chapter division or the section division, which puts the last part of verse 6, the new paragraph. But it says, when I saw her, I marveled greatly. So when we use that word marveled or we're amazed, we usually are like in awe, like it's a good thing. I saw this amazing thing. We usually don't describe negative things in amazing kind of language. What is John capturing here with that adjective?
What's interesting is this, the very next verse says, and the angel said to me, verse 7, 17:7, why do you marvel? Why do you wonder? Why are you amazed? Same word. Why do you wonder? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. So there's a measure of rebuke. So some have suggested, okay, what John's amazed about is he thought he was going to see the judgment of the great prostitute, and instead he's seeing this woman who appears triumphant. She's sitting on the back of a beast and she's triumphant. That's not uncommon. I think what's actually happening is that John's actually in a sense of awe or wonder. And I think that's true because that word amaze that you're pointing out or wonder is only used 4 times in the book of Revelation. And every time it has this sense of awe or wonder, like, oh, we're amazed. Like we're worshiping this and adoring what we're seeing. So in chapter 13, the whole earth was amazed at the beast because one of its heads had been healed. And this word amaze, I think, says, hey, John's amazed. He's being seduced by her because he sees the beauty of her. And I think I'm not sure if we mentioned this on the episode itself or we just talked beforehand last week, but there's a lot of pictures. If you go online on Google Images or images.google and say pictures of the book of Revelation, you're going to get all these images that people have drawn up. And they're actually cool, but don't look at them because what they do is you see the image and this woman is she's a prostitute. She looks like a prostitute, but I don't think that's what she looked like to John. I think what she looked like to John was this beautiful woman, the goddess Roma in all of her glory, sitting triumphantly, and John's seduced by her, and the angel comes like, why are you amazed? Stop. Don't you understand? She's nothing but a prostitute. Let me tell you about her. Oh, so I think it's a mild rebuke. It's hard to tell from the text, but I think the context suggests that it's an abuse, especially the word amazed.
No, that's actually
in awe.
But this is actually helpful because we oftentimes will hear the word prostitute or harlot and we'll, and I hate even making this comparison because we need to remember that all people are made in the image of God and have the same worth, but we might automatically think to like a Skid Row prostitute, the woman who looks just beaten up and is thrashed and you could just tell it's okay, this is a street worker, sex worker.
Yeah, exactly.
But we should be thinking of prostitute, and I'm just trying to draw popular parallels. This is the pretty woman prostitute. This is the woman who in a movie where a guy meets at a bar and he doesn't find out till later that she's a prostitute. And she just seems like this high class type person who's seductive in that kind of way. So even there, just for me, that's been helpful to not think of this in terms of someone that you would just assume, okay, she has the pimp and she just lives on the streets.
Yeah,
I know this is that.
Maybe I was going to say, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Yeah.
So if we're trying to find a parallel, so maybe that one works, but maybe it's like some MI6 agent who's undercover trying to seduce you because you're the corrupt politician that she actually wants to get in. Maybe something. So she's a beautiful agent, but she's not what she seems. Yeah.
No, I don't know if either one of those work, but.
Okay.
It's closer to popularly what we might think of.
Sure.
Like the automatic image might just be like the streetwalker prostitute. But like I said, when we think of that person though, and this is just where we need to pause and like, how have we been trained to view people? Yeah, and it's yeah, okay, exactly. they're scum, yeah. they're worthless, they're whatever. It's like, no, that person is someone's daughter, someone's sister, someone's niece or aunt or mom. And they have as much value as your daughter, parent, niece, aunt. Whatever. So we just need to make sure we're viewing those people in the same kind of way.
Yeah. And she often feels like she has no worth. So not only is she made in God's image and she a being of value and worth, but she actually feels worthless. She's only good for what she can provide. And that's so tragic. And Jesus welcoming them in.
Yeah.
A prostitute into the kingdom of God.
Yep.
Yes. Very good.
And that's where it's also different than this harlot, where this harlot, her telos in life, her end goal is to deceive people. That's what she wants to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas those people, like those women who are working in this context or in India or the Philippines or whoever, who are forced prostitutes, man, they didn't grow up as little girls thinking, man, the two things I'm dreaming about is having the beautiful wedding and being a princess and then being a prostitute. This wasn't her goal in life. There's other factors where she's a victim 10 times over of things. Yeah. Anyway, just the baggage that we bring into words and whatnot.
Yeah, very good. And maybe we can take this as an application point and give you an example of how this works in the modern day. We take our prosperity and then what we do, we say, I earned it. I deserve it. I'm a good person and it's a sign of God's blessing.
Yep.
And that's not quite so simple. For one, blessed are those who are persecuted, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are those who are hungry now. It's like, that's what the blessing looks like. Our material accumulation is not necessarily a sign of God's blessing. It doesn't mean that we did it by evil ways, but our materialism is not necessarily a sign of blessing, of divine blessing, because the poor are the ones who are blessed. The needy are the ones who are blessed. And I think we need to be careful. So there's an example like, whoa, have we been seduced to think our material prosperity is a sign of God's blessing.
Hey everyone, we want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we provide at Determined Truth is free of charge. And this even includes all of the teaching that Rob does on a weekly basis to pastors in India and around the world. We don't have any supporters that get special behind the scenes access. But we can only do this with the generous support that comes from those of you who can afford to give. So if you would prayerfully consider supporting us with anything from $5 a month or more, we will continue to work hard to challenge the church to be the church. To give, go to determinedtruth.com and click on the Give tab or follow the link in the show notes.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and actually, I'll take it one step further.
I was thinking about doing it, but I wasn't sure I was going to go there, so maybe you'll do it for me.
I'll preface this. I don't have a dog in the race of a financial economic ideology.
Okay.
And so I'm working a lot of stuff out in terms of, okay, what is a Christian worldview of economics and that sort of thing. So this is not like a covert Trojan horse way of sneaking something in. But I'm being completely transparent on that one.
Good.
However, I was challenged years ago with something where, because I grew up with that mindset of this person, they're blessed because they worked harder, so they deserve this.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had a Christian friend, a pastor, challenge me. And he didn't have a perspective either. He was just challenging that thought. And his thing was, you're telling me that the CEO, he's worth his $50 million a year thing, paycheck, bonus, because he works harder than the single mom who works two jobs during the day. What is he doing that she's not doing? And I'm not saying that there's not rewards that we get for training. And I'm not like covertly sneaking in like a socialist agenda. Like, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like the mom who's literally working two jobs to support her kids, she just isn't working hard enough as the CEO. And that's why he deserves it. And she's barely scraping by. It's just not as simple. The point is I'm trying to make, it's not a one-to-one comparison.
Yeah.
And then there is something to be critiqued about societies though, in economic systems. Every economic system has something to be critiqued.
Absolutely. Yeah.
With the great prostitute though, we talked last week about how she is Rome. And you've already been recapping the material, the commercial side of the Roman Empire. Is there anything else that is part of John's description that we're missing, or is it just limited to that?
No, that's, I think we got a good idea. I think if we go through the rest of this passage in too much detail, we'll probably get lost because it gets to be riddle-ish a little bit. So trying to keep it simple, in chapter 17, verse 18, which is the last verse of chapter 17, it says, the woman whom you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. But she's not the great city in a political sense. That's the beast. She's the great city in terms of materialistic cultural sense of commercialism and prosperity. She's sitting on the beast, as we said in chapter 17, verse 3. And that is, there's an ironic mocking of her in chapter 18, where it says, oh, she says in her heart, I sit as a queen. And see, she's sitting on the beast. Ah, I'm a queen. I will never be a widow. Ah, guess what's going to happen? This is what's going to come your way. And we'll get to chapter 18 next. The other contrast is that she's sitting on the beast, probably contrasts the fact that God's the one sitting on the throne. And Rome's not the place of the throne, but God's rule from his heavenly kingdom is the place of the throne. So the one who actually rules is not the empire. The one who actually rules is Christ.
Okay. What would that mean for us today if we were to pause? We've been doing this where instead of coming to the end of the podcast and having application points, I think it's good to pause in the text itself. What does that mean for us today in terms of if there's a one-to-one carryover, empires are still the beast in a sense. It's not merely Rome. And this is from an economic side, a commercial side of things, but Jesus is still sitting on the throne today as he was 2,000 years ago. What does that mean for us?
I think it means a whole lot more, especially to the Western church, than I think you and I have even begun to admit ourselves. As we said before, I think we're both processing this ourselves. I've been processing the idea of the beast for 25 or more years. I've been processing the harlot idea for a number of years now. Obviously, this is kind of what I've been doing for years. The problem is that there are biblical scholars who know the text really well, whether it's Matthew and the Gospels of Jesus and the Kingdom of God, or the fulfillment of the prophecies of Isaiah in light of the New Testament, or the book of Revelation and what this means. There are biblical scholars. And then there are people that are in tune with the way the world actually works today. Because remember, the biblical scholars, we're 20 centuries earlier, 19 centuries earlier, right? We're in the first century or the Old Testament world. And so now we have to deal with, what does this mean today? It's hard because we need political scientists and foreign affairs experts and politicians, those who have inside knowledge as to what's going on in those situations, to help inform one another. The biblical scholars inform them. This is what the biblical story is about, the kingdom of God's about. And then they help inform us in terms of what's going on in the world today. And we try to put the two together. And the problem is that's really hard to do because when you get an education, you know what your niche is, you know what you're good at, and you feel competent in that. But you also know how much you don't know about everything else. That's one of the things what happens when you get educated, right? Oh my goodness, there's so much to know about Revelation. I'm not going to comment on Isaiah because I don't know anything about it. And you're like, Rob, of course. You're like, no, I don't. You know, and people don't understand when I say things like that. Like, I'm a New Testament guy. Like, Rob, you know the Old Testament really well. I'm like, no, I really don't, because there's so much depth that I have no idea what it is. And so that's the same thing, that there's a measure of trepidation, of fear, of saying, I want to be cautious about speaking into this situation because I don't know everything. But from what I know, that sure looks beast-like to me, the way the nations wage war. That's beast-like. Jesus explicitly says, we don't do things the way the kings of the world do. The Gentiles lord it over those in authority, but not so with you. So we can see beast-likeness in the way nations act. And there's a sense where, I've said before, what Jesus says and what he does, nations can't actually apply that ethic. You can't go, Vladimir Putin, I love you so much, so I'm going to lay down my life for you as the president of the United States, because you're going to be overthrown. So there is this threat assessment that nations go through, and they have this military that to overcome the threat assessment. That's fine. But then there's this element, and this is why I think the great prostitute fits in today, and that is, I think she represents the big corporations and the money and the profit and how much they influence empires. The American empire, it's an empire, let's call it that. And it's better than others in many ways, but I think it's worse than others in other ways. The American empire is one where we're a democracy, but the reality is the people are so influenced by advertisements, campaigns, and what goes on the media, the knowledge that we get, the information that we get. But the information that we get is filtered down. We don't get all the details. We don't know everything inside out. And ultimately, there are lobbying groups that have massive influence over Congress. So I'll give you an example. I do a lot of work, as we know, Israel, Palestine, and all that good stuff. AIPAC is perhaps the American Israel Political Action Committee, is perhaps the most powerful lobbyist group in the United States government and has most senators, congressmen in their pocketbook. And the reality is, if you come into power and the AIPAC says, hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give $100,000 to your campaign, which is almost nothing, but they do this all the time. And we want you to understand what our goals are. If you don't take that money, guess what? They're going to give it to somebody else who will run against you in the next election. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows this. Why can the United States not condemn what Israel's doing on Gaza? And again, there's the Israel-Gaza thing is very complex. I'm not speaking negatively about Israel per se, although I think that they need to stop this onslaught of Gaza because it's not even in their best interest in the long run. This is not going to bring security to Israel. But it's certainly not a good thing in any way, shape, or form, and it's not good to the United States. But there's also then these big corporations. So I wrote a series of blogs. One last anecdote here, Vinny. And again, as we said, one last anecdote does not necessarily mean one last anecdote. It just means the last one that I can think of at this point in time. But I wrote a series of posts a year, maybe a year and a half ago as we're recording this. So early 2024 now, I think it's the fall of 2022 on FIFA. At the time, the World Cup was being played in December because it was in Qatar. And you're like, how can you have a World Cup in Qatar when the World Cup is in June and it's 112 to 120 in Qatar? Somebody lined somebody's pockets. And so I was writing about FIFA as an example of the beast. And really, it's more like the great prostitute because FIFA comes in and says to Brazil a number of years ago, the World Cup was in Brazil. And Brazil had a policy saying, we will not sell alcohol in our stadiums because too many people are dying in Brazilian soccer games. By the way, notice that the beer companies didn't have enough influence, the alcohol companies, over the government of Brazil. So Brazil said, we're going to do what's in the best interest of the people. And the companies didn't have power over that. And so they did. They enacted this law. FIFA comes in and says, well, if you want the World Cup in Brazil, I think it's Heineken is one of the major sponsors of FIFA and of the World Cup. That's one of our sponsors. You're going to sell alcohol in your stadiums or you don't get the World Cup. And if you don't get the World Cup, we're going to bring in hundreds of billions of dollars into your country. And it's going to be good for all these streets and roads and welfare programs, which it never went to, by the way. Yeah, it never did that. That's how FIFA can influence the government of Brazil to say, we have this law, but we're going to change it for the World Cup. Now, to finish that anecdote, because this is not another anecdote, I want to make sure I'm still in the same one. But Qatar is obviously an Islamic country, and they don't sell alcohol. You can't drink alcohol in the country. So FIFA did the same thing to Qatar. And Qatar said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to allow this one area of the stadiums to have alcohol. That's it. Only there. If you want to have alcohol, you have to go over there and get it. And you have to consume it there. And then you can come back to your seat, which means you'll miss some of the game. And they said, we'll have this one area downtown, which is like this, the square for the World Cup, where all the goods and the parties are at. And we'll let you have alcohol there. FIFA said, okay. And so they make this agreement. And then the World Cup starts. And the day before the World Cup started, they actually banned alcohol in the stadium. And FIFA couldn't do anything about it. You could only have alcohol in that square. So Qatar got them back. But the idea of that is how corporations, or in this case, FIFA, was able to influence legislation and countries had to bow down to it because of the financial resources that were there. And so how much do these companies have an influence on politicians so that, let me give you another controversial example, so that we're not going to worry about being green for the sake of environmentalism because oil companies and big business are saying, if you guys do that, you're going to lose our votes and you're going to lose our money and we're going to finance somebody else to take your Senate seat from you. I think that's an example of how this plays out in our modern world today.
It's interesting, going back to the World Cup example with Qatar, because if you know anything about Islam, regardless of your value judgment on the religion, if it's correct or not, just know, look at the people groups. Islamic people, and especially Islamic nations, they are scrupulous about dietary issues and alcohol. And so the fact that even though they came back at the end and said, no, psych, just kidding. The fact that they would consider compromising.
Yeah.
It would be similar to, it would be the exact equivalent to having, if I'm just coming up with a random one, the World Cup's going to be played in Israel. However, a pork company is a major sponsor, a hot dog company that's not kosher or something like that, is a major sponsor. And they said, no, you have to sell these pork hot dogs. It would be like Israel saying, okay, we're okay with that. In the, you could have this one section
for the 2 weeks.
They would not do that. And it's the same exact thing with alcohol. So the fact that they would even consider, even though it was a bait and switch, that showing the level of enticement that the finances bring in the financial world.
That's right.
Yeah.
When I teach worldview stuff, I always say that really what you do when you compare the kingdoms of the world and kingdoms of the world, put them in one bucket, all the kingdoms of the world in one bucket. In the other bucket, you have the kingdom of God. And they're contrasting kingdoms. Power works differently. They both use the cross. The kingdoms of the world put people on crosses to maintain their power. And sometimes they're good. Don't misunderstand. They're not all evil and corrupt. But in the kingdom of God, Jesus goes on the cross to demonstrate his power. He dies and suffers violence instead of inflicting violence, which is obviously something that we've been discussing a lot in the book of Revelation. But the next thing to say is how much money actually influences power. So 1 Timothy, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. So I would say it's power, but power cannot be separated from money, because where the money is comes the comfort and the security, and that's the way of obtaining power. If you have enough money, you can influence Congress. And that's why I know some people that will say, we really don't actually have a democracy per se, because the poor can never run for a campaign. They can never get financing. They can't compete against the ones who have the financial backing. And even right there. And then the next question becomes, those who get in power, and this isn't necessarily that they're being evil, but the reality is, to stay in power, they have to do favors to the people who got them in power, and that wasn't the poor again. The poor didn't get you in power. The people who got you in power were the money backers who sponsored your campaign. I think this is what the beast and the great prostitute look like in action. And therefore, as we said last week, John's taken to a wilderness to see the great prostitute, but the wilderness is where God's people are. The only other two times it's used is chapter 12. He carried the woman away into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. Where the prostitute is where we are. It's in our midst and it's not out there.
Yeah. Another way of looking at this is that the prostitute, and we could even put that with the beast, the false prophet, the dragon, you know, anyone on this side of the equation, they're a counterfeit. And a good counterfeit is going to try to appear as close as possible to the thing that they are imitating. And so we also need to know that we think that we're a lot smarter than we are. And so I would note this, though. I would be able to identify this great prostitute. No, you wouldn't.
Exactly.
We are being deceived by it today.
Yes.
That kind of maybe brings me into my next question. We could lump it together. But the beast, the false prophet, the great prostitute, they're a sort of trinity. You know, I don't know if we want to use trinity. They're a triad. Okay. They're, you know, especially like in Trinitarian language, it's not a trinity in a sense. Right, but this is also a symbolic book. But this is a counterfeit trinity, if you will, or a false trinity or something. And it's going to deceive you. This isn't Ghostbusters where you could automatically look at the ghost and say, oh, this is obviously a mean one because it looks mean. No, it's going to look amazing.
Exactly. Satan masquerades as an angel of light. He looks good. He looks something that's trustworthy. And his primary weapon is deception. Exactly. My mentor would say that Satan cannot create. Only God can create out of nothing. So all Satan can do is imitate what God has already done. And take something that God has done and then use it for whatever ends. So Satan is the great imitator. That's exactly what he is. Yep.
Yeah. Getting to the comparison, though, of the true Trinity versus a counterfeit Trinity or a triad. What are the connections that we're seeing now that we've seen the beasts and the false prophet and the prostitute and all that? Like, how do we make these connections?
The satanic Trinity is the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Those are the three persons of the Trinity that are imitating the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
So the great prostitute would not be part of that group then?
Would not be part of that Trinity of ruling, because she doesn't rule. She influences the ones who do rule. So I think that's your satanic trinity in the book of Revelation. That's probably what 666 is suggesting, not 777 and the three numbers, because it's the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, or it's the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. When you see the harlot, what you're seeing then is more of what we might call a triad, the three things that embody the enemies of God's people.
Okay. What do you mean? So how would we use triad versus trinity then? What do you mean by triad?
Triad is something in threes. A triad is a group of three.
Okay. So how connect me then to the harlot, to the triad? Like, how is she a triad?
Yeah. You have the empire, which is the beast. They have the false prophet, which is the imperial propaganda of the beast that caused you to worship the beast. And then you have the great prostitute, which is the material and economic part of the empire. These three are working together to oppose God. In other words, worship the beast. And if you do, then you've been seduced by the false prophet or deceived by the false prophet. But the reason for doing that is because you want the material comforts. You want to eat tomorrow. You want material gain. Or maybe you're a king, or maybe you're a merchant, and you're prospering because of Rome's atrocities. So guess what? We got all these goods that, and we'll look at the goods next week when we get to chapter 18. We have all these goods that flow into Rome, and this abundance of ivory and tables and wood and roses. And I get to partake of some of these meals, and this is great. Oh, I didn't realize that Rome actually just ravaged Africa and destroyed all the rhinos to get all the ivory from, or these trees that they make these tables from that just deforested certain parts of Africa. I'm going to turn a blind eye to that because I'm benefiting from the material gain of these things, which again goes back to today. Are we benefiting from the fact that the Amazon's being raped and destroyed, which is causing serious ramifications, or because oil is being mined that's harming the environment? But guess what? I need that fuel to my car so I can get to work, and there's nothing I can do about it. And maybe there isn't, but maybe we can fly less often. Maybe we can carpool more often. Maybe we can get a motorcycle. Maybe we can move closer to our work. Are there other ways to do this?
Yeah, it's also interesting because we really like to separate in a category. You could have your ruling empire over here with your politicians and everything, and then you could have worship over here, and you can have materialism over here. Like we think that they're all separate. First off, in the Roman Empire, there's no separation in these things. You can't have one without the other. Everything is mixed together. But it's also interesting. You've probably never watched the HBO show The Wire.
No.
It's about Baltimore.
My TV is stuck on ESPN. I can't find any other channels. No, when you put the VHS,
the DVD, the VHS, yeah. But it's interesting because this is a TV show that was on HBO 20 plus years ago. It's pretty graphic, but it's showing Baltimore. And there's five seasons, and each one of the seasons, it starts off with the gang and the drug trade in Baltimore, right? Inner city and all this stuff. But each season has a different focus, where it's like one season is we could call it the materialism of the drug trade. It's the stuff itself. And so it's talking about how the police are interacting with the drug wars of Baltimore. But you have a season where they're focusing on the longshoremen and how drugs are brought in. So obviously this is affecting commerce. You have a season that's really focusing on the school system and how that plays a part in here. You have a season that focuses on the newspapers and the media, right? Each season had a different focus. And it's just interesting how, while we think those entities are all separate things, it's showing the inner workings on how all the pieces matter here in terms of how you're looking at the drug trade. It affects the schools, it affects business, it affects politics. Yeah. We think that things are much more separate in the world than they are, but they're actually not. These things are just as entwined. Mm. In Rome in the first century, we would know that these things are all interconnected. But in America, we think that we have these separations, and we actually don't.
Yep.
All right, let's move on to verses 8 through 13. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are one of mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. So this kind of reads like a riddle or something.
Yeah, it is a riddle. And of course, the problem with the riddle is that we don't have the answer. It seems that John's readers had the ability to know what he was talking about. If there is some literal referent, then the fact that they're exhorted in 17 verse 9, here's the mind which has wisdom, or here's the mind, the one having wisdom would be a literal translation of it. It seems to suggest you guys know what I mean by this. The problem with that is, and we just won't go into the details, we just can't do it here. there's no explanation that we know of today that would have made sense in that generation. Like, so we can do 666 and go, okay, this is Nero. You got to fine tune it a little bit, put his name in Hebrew. So I think what we would simply say is the fact that it doesn't have a literal referent in the sense that these seven heads are actually seven kings. And this is number one, this is number two, this is number three. We don't know who those even would be. I don't think actually that's the case. I think what's happening, and I think there's a good number of really good scholars that are in agreement on this, would say that the numbers are purely symbolic and they have no literal referent. David Barr says that a series of seven events no longer need to be read as a literal sequence, for we know that seven represents completion. Thus, any sequence of any length will be a sequence of seven in John's system. If John says there are 10 rulers, we don't need to try to count them or identify them. There will always be 10 whenever John's talking about the imperial powers of this age. I think Barr's correct, and I think if he is, then these aren't 10 particular kings. They're not seven particular kings. The beast isn't one particular king that was one of the seven, is now an eighth. I don't think that's what's going on at all. I think they represent all the kingdoms in history, seven and 10 being symbolic numbers for completion and totality. Obviously, seven for totality regarding God and creation, but 10 totality regarding the law, the world. I think that's all that's happening then.
I just want to point something out too. Oftentimes when you study the book of Revelation, popularly we're decoding. This means this, yeah. And everyone is 100% certain on what everything means. And there's times like what you said, no, you are confident 666 means this. And yeah, you might, maybe you'd say, oh, I could be persuaded maybe, but you're holding this pretty tightly. This is something where you're like, yeah, I don't know what this means. And it's symbolic and you're okay with that. And this is also the difference between maybe what we're trying to do and how we're trying to teach how to read Revelation. It's not just another alternative to the popular reading where, no, we're showing you how to decode everything. Sometimes something's just symbolic and there's nothing behind it. Nothing literal behind it.
Exactly. So the way I usually approach this, and we might have discussed this like a couple weeks ago when we did our introductory episodes. Was that 3 or 4 weeks ago?
A couple weeks ago. Yeah. It was a month and a half ago.
Yeah. Or it was like January, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was January.
2022. But is numbers in apocalyptic literature are always symbolic. They may have a literal referent also. So the seven lampstands are the seven churches. But the primary significance is not that there are seven actual churches. It's that there are seven, which represents all of Christendom. Now, they may also refer to seven actual churches. So the primary referent of the seven heads and the 10 horns are that there are seven heads and 10 horns, and they represent all the kingdoms of the world. They may also represent seven kings or 10 kings, but if they do, we have no way in the 21st century of figuring out what it meant.
Yeah. We hope you're enjoying the podcast, and we want to remind you that everything we do at Determine Truth, the podcast, Rob's blog, and our YouTube channel is available on the Determine Truth app. Directions on how to download the app is available in the show notes and on the DetermineTruth.com website. Just click on the app tab. The passage continues on in verse 14. It says, they will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he, the Lamb, is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called chosen and faithful.
So this is going to be really important, because that issue of Armageddon from chapter 16, that we said, here's our answer to chapter 16 and what Armageddon means. But as we go further, we're going to see this answer actually becomes further substantiated, finds more support. Every time the word war is used in Revelation, or the war, the seven times, it always refers to a war against Jesus or God's people, with the one exception that was war in heaven, and that was against Michael. But that's not really an exception, is it? It's not ever referring to an actual war between Russia and Israel, or between Iran and Israel, or between Sudan, North and South. It never refers to that. It's always a war against Christ and the people of God, and it could include angels. So notice, it's not merely against the Lamb, because those who are with the Lamb, in verse 14, are the called, chosen, and faithful. If you're going to wage war against the Lamb, you can't. He's in heaven. He's resurrected. The only way you can wage war against Christ is to wage war against his people. And when he separates the sheep from the goats, he says, whatever you did to the least of these brothers of mine, you did to me. So the war here is explicit. It's against the Lamb. But it's against the Lamb because they're waging war against God's people. Now, in chapter 19, we'll see it again. It's against the Lamb at the return of Christ. No problem. That's fine. Christ returns. wages war, but it's not much of a battle.
And isn't that just going to be ancient Near Eastern thought anyway, and Greco-Roman thought? If I want to defeat a god, I defeat the people, because if I defeat the people, that means my god was greater than your god anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, very good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The next section, we're running low on time, but the next three verses, 15 through 18, that the great prostitute is destroyed. Anything you wanted to add on to that?
Let's go ahead and read the verses, if you don't mind. 15 through 18, I'm sorry.
The angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated, and peoples and multitudes and nations and languages, and the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beasts will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth."
What we see here is the great prostitute, that commercial side, that material side, is defeated by the 10 horns and the beast, these 10 kings, whatever they are. And I think this is what happens with empires. Empires implode almost always from within first. And of course, their allies ultimately become the ones that actually end up destroying them. And I think that's what we see here. The harlot is destroyed because the lust of the kings of the world can never be ultimately satisfied. And it caused them to actually destroy the very thing that gives them their satisfaction. That is their commercialism, their trade. It becomes a self-imploding thing. Maybe we could say something like, when you ravage all the trees in a certain part of Africa to get citron wood and to make these tables was very difficult. Guess what? Eventually, there's no trees left and you've ravaged them. And now it implodes because your economy was built on ivory and there's no more rhinos left, or your economy was built on oil and there's no more oil left, or your economy was built on oil. And guess what oil did? It destroyed the nature. I think that's what we see happening here.
Okay. So that finished up chapter 17. Chapter 18, It describes the judgment of the great prostitute. It's this great kind of poetic parallelism that's laid out for a chapter. It's look at 18 next time. But I know that one thing that pops up for me is oftentimes, and I do come from the complementarian world.
Yes.
And there's, I think, appropriate ways and very inappropriate ways to look at gender roles.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, this section is looked at as a way to say part of the judgment is a woman usurping authority on a man. And that's why the problem is that she's this evil leader, and it's because women shouldn't be leading. I think that's totally inappropriate. The reason why she's being criticized is because she's a harlot and she's enacting violence on the people of God, and she's associated with this unholy trinity and that sort of thing. But what are ways that we can, look at John's portrayal of women? Because this isn't the only woman that's in the book.
This is actually an issue. Some, what we might want to call the more liberal world, would say, yeah, the Bible is just simply doing what everybody else does. It's misogynistic. It's patriarchal. Women are no good except for as prostitutes. And there is a sense where there's like, yeah, I wish John would have just come up with another image for this. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's his culture, and that's us imposing our culture on him to some extent. And that's kind of where we're at. But especially the idea that verse 16, it says that the 10 horns and the beast will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, will eat her flesh and burn her up with fire. Oh, see, they're raping her. And that's what happens. Mm. And it's this imagery of sexual prostitution and rape and things of that nature. And I would simply say this, that John's using women because Roma was the goddess of Rome, and she was the one that was the actual power over the imperial entity. So I point out in my commentary really briefly here, maybe we can finish on this. 7 points, most of which I've gleaned from other authors. David DeSilva has a lot of good things to say about this, as well as Barbara Rossing, she's a woman, obviously, and she's done some really good work on this. The first thing is, Revelation also portrays the people of God as a bride. Not only is the woman the bride, but that means us, you and I, Vinny, two men, are actually a woman, according to the book of Revelation. So it's not depicting women in a negative light in all cases. Secondly, it's not actually meant to say that Babylon actually is a prostitute. It's the goddess Rome, as I said earlier.
Yeah.
And it's the imperial symbol. The third thing I'd say, and that is, this is actually building off the biblical imagery of Proverbs chapters 1-9. So Proverbs 1-9 are contrasting, where do you get wisdom from? Mm. There's Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly. That's all it is. It's just this biblical imagery of wisdom. Where does wisdom come from? I guess another point would be the feminine pronouns. Is that's because the Greek word city was a feminine word and required feminine pronouns. But the key thing to point out, and again, there's a sense where, yeah, I wish there would be a different image that John would have used because I see this potential problem and I see how it could be used that way. But I think the key thing is that John was not a person in power. Patriarchy and misogyny are men in power usurping that power and authority over women and causing women to suffer as a result of that. And that is a true thing in this world. I've written on my blog that the greatest injustice in the world today is gender injustice because it affects half the people in the world. One out of every two people essentially are women, and they're impacted in some way, shape, or form. And the violence against women globally is really horrible. But John's not in a position of power. In fact, John is actually one of the oppressed. He's on Patmos when he got the vision, at least, maybe not when he wrote the book itself. But he is not reflecting a position of misogyny and patriarchy because John doesn't have the power to influence and exclude Jezebel from the church, for example, in Revelation chapter 2. And then the last thing is chapter 17, verse 16 is not depicting rape. Barbara Rossing says, what happens here is the consequences of siege warfare and burning with fire and a violent overtaking as a result of warfare, not as a result of misogyny and rape and abuse of women. So I think it is an issue. I think we need to recognize that it's an issue. I think we need to be cautious about it and recognize the fact that violence against women and the Me Too movement, there's something there. And it's not, I'm a little older than you, Vinny. So my generation was all about the women's libbers. We've got to keep them out of our church. Guys, they want liberation. Yeah, some of them want more than that. I get it. But some of them want just equal pay. Some of them want to be treated equally in a church pastor meeting where they can't be called pastors. We get that. But their voice should be the same as a male pastor in the room because God gave them gifts also. And I think that's something to be reckoned with.
I completely affirm that. And I think also something that struck me, even reading in your 7 points that you listed from your commentary, is male leadership in and of itself isn't necessarily patriarchy and misogynistic. Just because you're a male leader doesn't mean you are those things, or that it doesn't mean that the system is misogynistic in and of itself. It's what is the leader doing with his power if we're talking about male leadership. And that's something to note as well, that there could be healthy and unhealthy male leadership. And in the same way, there could be unhealthy and healthy female leadership.
Leadership in the church is submitting to, to the other. Husbands, lay down your lives for your wife, just as Christ laid down his life for the church.
Exactly. There's a lot more to be said, I'm just saying. So I have different thoughts on that. It's just, if you are there, this is what it needs to be. So cool. Chapter 18 next week. Are we actually going to get through the whole thing?
I think we'll get through 18 and the beginning of 19. So the section is 17:1 through 19:10. So our goal will be to do 18:1 through 19:10 and kind of look at the judgment, the destruction of Babylon, and what it means for the story of the book of Revelation. It's very significant. The narrative of Revelation, how long, O Lord, is going to get answered. The prayers of the saints are going to be answered.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you for that. I can't believe we're getting to this home stretch here. But read ahead to chapter 18 into 19. We'll see everyone next week.
I want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast, and we would love for you to share the work of Determined Truth with others. Please follow this podcast and give a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will go a long way towards helping others find this podcast. Then, share it with others so that we can get the word of the gospel of the kingdom to more people.